May the words of my mouth and the thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock and my redeemer. And now for the official introduction, and if you will, waiver for this class. Shalom all and welcome. I'm your host, Ariel Bart Sadok. You find me online at koshertorah.com. I'm going to memorize this one of these days, but not yet. I've entitled this course, An Orthodox Rabbi Reads the Christian Bible. My purpose and intent in teaching this course is simple. I want to be able to explain why Torah Judaism and Torah faithful Jews do not and will not accept or embrace the teachings of the Christian religion. I have no intentions or desire in this course to attack the religion of Christianity. I am not here to challenge or critique those who embrace the Christian faith. I'm not here to talk about Christianity at all. Even though due to the nature of this material, I'm sure that I will not be able to avoid the topic entirely. Nevertheless, I am here to look at the Christian Bible from an entirely Torah point of view. I begin with certain premises. I do not deny the existence of an historical Yeshu, be he called Yeshua or what. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be the Messiah of Israel. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be a God, or even a son of God, any more than any other human being of flesh and blood. For the record, the historical Yeshu was born, lived as, and died as a Jew. He and his original followers were all Jews, who, like him, were born, lived as, and died as Jews. Absolutely none of them were Christians in any sense of the word. We Torah faithful Jews follow the same religion that Yeshu himself practiced. We pray to the same Heavenly Father. We live by the same Torah, mitzvot, and ma'asim tovim. Yeshu was not a Christian, neither are we. Yeshu's original followers were all Torah-observant Jews, as was he. As Jews, educated in Torah, drenched in its teachings, and from what can be seen, knowing no other spiritual path, I must logically conclude that the original writings of Yeshu's original followers were all Jewish writings, and therefore well within my domain as a Torah-observant rabbi to read them, understand them as would one rabbi to another. I therefore begin with the position that anything found in the Christian Bible attributed to any of its Jewish authors that does not agree with Torah Judaism must not have been written by such an author, and is therefore subject to suspicion and must be critically analyzed. And that is what I am here to do. Like many Torah sages before me, I do not accept the Talmudic Midrash about Yeshu at face value. Those teachings were meant to be polemic, not historical. Therefore, they will not be part of our discussions. Now, I've been led to perform this work because of the experiences of my personal life. As a teenager, I was victimized by a terrible evangelical group in my hometown on Long Island. This group was led by a very evil, lying, deceitful individual who turned out also to be a pedophile. I am thankful that I was able to escape being victimized in that way. Nevertheless, this individual sought to clandestinely place his minions in Orthodox yeshivot in Israel to get them to learn about Judaism, the attempt to make it easier for them to persuade Jews to convert and join their fold. I fought long and hard against this group, and I'm proud of my contributions in thwarting their efforts. It was through them and because of them that I became exposed to Christianity. I've therefore devoted the last 40 years of my life to study and investigation to discover whatever of the truth that is still out there to be discovered. Now, after 40 years, I feel confident and ready to share my insights and discoveries with you. So again, I reiterate, I am not here to attack our God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian neighbors. I hold them in the highest esteem and respect. I'm here to explain to you, to them at all willing to listen, what we Torah faithful Jews see when we read the Christian Bible, and why we see what we do. And now, let us proceed with tonight's lesson, which, if I'm not mistaken, is lesson 6 in this series. Now, we're in the middle, or actually at the conclusion, of the Sermon of the Mount. We're going to start with chapter 7 tonight. And again, I reiterate, as a book that I'm holding here as a very interesting resource entitled The Jewish Sources of the Sermon of the Mount, written by a Rabbi Gerald Friedlander in London in 1911. Wow, 103 years old. And his insights are very interesting, and I, of course, will have been sharing them with you, and I will continue to do so now. But a point that I think is so important, again, I reiterate, I'm being repetitive now. You know how much I hate being repetitive, but I feel I have to say it. Christians, for the most part, are completely uneducated about anything Jewish. I should say anything legitimately Jewish. Because anything and everything that they're taught about Jews and Judaism is going to come through a very cloudy filter. Christianity as a religion, the history of the Catholic Church and Protestantism not so far behind, is full of racism, violence, anti-Semitism of all kinds. And every Christian Bible commentary that I have picked up, I see it. It might be subtle, it might be overt, but it is there. And I don't think that even many a Christian understand or know or recognize it. They are convinced because they've been told for, I don't know, centuries that their religion, their morality is superior, that they are spiritual and the Jews are this and that, etc. and so on. Well, the point that I've been trying to make throughout the Sermon on the Mount teachings here is just how Jewish these teachings really are. So while Christianity and Christians hold the Sermon on the Mount on a pedestal as the pinnacle of Christian morality, I tried to show them what you're praising as Christian morality is good old-fashioned Torah Judaism, which any rabbinic scholar will know and recognize. And again, my intent isn't to take the Sermon on the Mount off of its pillar. Indeed, these are great Jewish teachings. I hope and pray that we can recognize them as the Jewish teachings that they are, so that people can have, I pray God, more respect for as opposed to animosity for Jews and Judaism. Chapter 7, the Sermon on the Mount opens up with something I've heard for years, and I think it's probably one of the more famous teachings, where in which Yeshua is said to have said, "Judge not, that ye not be judged." Wow, that's pretty cool. "But with that judgment that ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be meted out to you." Okay, I got it. Tell me, again I ask, what is so Christian about this statement? Indeed, let me share with you this. Those same sentiments are actually right from the Talmud. It's a teaching that you will find in the Talmud in Tractate Sota 8b, in the name of Rabbi Meir, who says that the same measure with man with which a man measures shall be measured to him. And I want to share with you a little words again from Rabbi Friedlander's book on page 214 at the bottom. He writes, quoting here from Rabbi Yoshua ben Parachia, he quotes again from Pirkei Avot, "Not that you should not judge, but rather judge all men in the scale of merit." And Rabbi Friedlander is now going to compare these two. And he says like this, "In our opinion, this Pharisaic teaching of Rabbi Yoshua ben Parachia is infinitely superior to that of the gospel. In the first instance, it's impossible to carry out literally the gospel injunction. Man will always pass judgment on his fellows. And again, the gospel saying is inferior because it is in the negative, while the rabbinic saying is in the positive, universal, based on the ultimate human principle of love, an idea and a concept most Christians would never think Jews hold and embrace. Why does the gospel tell a man not to judge his fellow? Because if he should disobey, he will be judged by God. This sanction of fear is absent from the rabbinical saying. The dictum, judge all men in the scale of merit, has been expanded into the teaching, quoting here Sabbath 127b, he who judges his neighbor in the scale of merit will himself be judged in the scale of merit." So, we see here that what Yeshua is saying, that as you are judged, as you judge, so you shall be judged, is actually a Jewish teaching we find in the Talmud. And And I introduced this in our last class, and I'm going to expand on it right now, that this is a teaching brought down even to Judaism to this day. I want to share with you the words of the famous Baal Shem Tov, founder of the Hasidic system. In Parashat Kodeshim of the book Baal Shem Tov, he states like this. Now I'll read the Hebrew and then I'll translate. Yargil atzmo ledun et kol harasha'im ha'ovrim leta'avon lekav zechut. This language, for those of you who know Hebrew, should recognize, this is even a little bit more strict. Listen, you should regulate yourselves to judge all the wicked, all right, who violate for the sake of their lusts. Judge them, as he says here, with a measure, with a good measure. Kav zechut. All right? And now, he goes on and he continues. Dinoda. Dim adam elemed chov al eis rasha. Viposek alav et adin. Omer sheru'i hu sheyavo ala poranut kaze kaze. If a person looks at someone who he considers to be wicked, and he condemns him, and he says this, judgment should fall on his person's head. Right? This is what should happen to him. What you yourself think should happen to the other guy, this is what's going to happen to you. Wow. Even though you don't sin in that respect, he says here, it's still as if you can sin. Now here's, again, an echo of what Yeshu said in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, "Ki'ilu na'ase averatz," as if you did a sin. Because one who is considered prideful is considered as one who commits adultery. One who is angry as if one who commits idolatry. So ultimately, remember Yoshi said, you know, if you think about something, etc. and so on. Again, these are not Christian thoughts. They're Jewish thoughts. And again, the Baal Shem Tov goes into greater detail to explain how God goes around to bring this type of judgment. Now, everybody judges. A judge is not judging, it's judgment. For example, the big term today is people say, I don't want to be judged. I don't want to be judgmental. But you know something? Everything in life is a judgment. When you go to the grocery store, and you're choosing whether or not to buy a box of Cheerios or Wheaties, you're making a judgment call. I hate to tell you. I don't think you're condemning the Wheaties to hell because you're buying the Cheerios. Everything is in judgment. If somebody comes into your place of business and acts in a suspicious manner, you're going to make a judgment call based upon that and act accordingly. If someone interacts with you in an inappropriate or in an offensive manner, you're going to react in a way which is different from if somebody's in a pleasant and pleasing manner. Now, when it says to judge somebody, like the Baal Shem Tov elaborated, we don't condemn people. You know, so that's the way people are. It's not my choice to be around such and such or such types of people. They do what they do. And what they do is between them and God. I'm not here to judge. Isn't that true? That's the way it should be for everybody. So I get this. The Baal Shem Tov echoes it. The Talmud itself, thousands of years before, echoed it. And the writings of Rabbi Yoshua ben Parachia judge all men with the scale of merit. You know something? That has an echo of truth. That doesn't mean, here, for example, God forbid, in a case of a violent crime, you have a person who commits a terrible crime against someone else and goes into court and says, have mercy on me, I'm poor, I didn't have a good upbringing, I'm an orphan, and on with all these sob stories. You know, I really, really do feel sorry for the individual. But yet at the same time, that's not going to blur the fact that the person is guilty of a crime and therefore must be punished for that crime. Period. And that's just the way it is. Someone is guilty of the death penalty and they're truly, sincerely remorseful. You walk them to the gallows hand in hand, you hug them and you say goodbye and there you go. But you don't forgive because criminal behavior has to be punished, or otherwise there'd be lawlessness. So understand the parameters of forgiveness. I will give you a little wise words of advice. You can forgive, but don't necessarily forget. There's an old saying that I heard, if you remember, from Scotty on Star Trek. I don't know where else it came from. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So therefore, while I might forgive somebody, bottom line, I'll keep an eye on you. I'll keep you at arm's distance, and I won't allow you into a position to do something again. But judging? Forgive me. I'm a teacher. I am not a judge. I do not have a court. There's no jury present. There's no bailiff. There's no prosecutor. People judge themselves. And that's in God's hands. And that's just the way it is. On that note, again, remember, this is supposed to have been a compilation of teaching. So they have him continuing. Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but consider not the beam that is in thy own eye? Really? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote of thy eye, and behold the beam that is in your own eye? You hypocrite, thou hypocrite. First cast out the beam out of thy own eye, and then shalt thou clearly be cast out the mote of thy brother's eye. Really? So in other words, people are hypocrites. Really? Wow. What a concept. But again, almost word for word, this is a quote from the Talmud. Tractate Erechim 16b. Rabbi Tarfon, who, again, Rabbi Friedlander puts in parentheses here, says a contemporary of Matthew and Luke. Quote, I wonder if there be a man in this generation that will allow himself to be reproved. If someone says to his fellow, cast out the mote out of thine eye, he will retort, cast out the beam out of thy own eye. He says this also actually quoted in Baba Batra. So you see, what Yeshu is saying here, like certain church fathers have already noticed, is that these are classical Jewish teachings. We should reclaim them as such. We shouldn't cast them away. You know the old saying, you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Now, switching a wee bit, Yeshu now is caught. Listen to these words. Verse 6. Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under your feet and turn again and rend you. Question. What's he talking about here? What is that which is holy, and who are the dogs? There's a dramatic pause here for you to think for a second. Now, I'll answer you in Yeshu's own words. Later on in the gospel here, there is a story that states that a non-Jewish woman wanting healing comes up to Yeshu and grabs onto the what's called the fringe of his garment, or as we would call in Hebrew, his tzitzit. His little tzitzit's hanging out. And he turns around and says, Master, could you heal me? And he says to her, does the dog eat off the master's table? Do you get it? He called this non-Jewish woman a dog. Now this, I think, is echoed right here again with Yeshu's terms. Yeshu was a racist. I'm sorry, I know that is very offensive to the Christian to hear. But you go look into the commentaries, and I did. When Yeshu referred to that woman as a dog, the commentary, I think, was equally anti-Semitic as Yeshu was anti-Gentile. The commentary, I think it was the Matthew Henry, but I might be mistaken, forgive me. It said that that's the kind of derogatory statement a Jew would make about a Gentile. Oh, really? That's very nice. Thank you very much. We all know anti-Semitism. Yes, there is anti-Gentilism. Many a Jew, even to this day, are racist and chauvinist. It is evil and wrong when we find it in Christians. It is equally evil and wrong when we find it in Jews. When a Jew wants to go and thump his chest and say, "I'm the chosen people." Really? Then get down on your hands and knees and start cleaning up the crap. Because that's what God chose us to do. Right? That's what tikkun, for those of you who know Kabbalah, is all about. It's not going up there and thumping your chest about how great we are. It's to say how much obligation and responsibility we have. Now, Yeshu called Gentiles dogs. And his emphasis here is, give not that which is holy to the dogs. If you look throughout the later Gospels, Yeshu did not want his students talking to non-Jews. He said, stay away from the, forgive me, but I'll say it as Yeshu would have, stay away from the Goyim. All right? Don't give them anything. All right? Don't cast your pearls before swine. Remember, in spite of what Christians think today, Yeshu was a political personage. He was starting an underground movement leading towards insurrection against the Roman Empire. He only wanted like-minded Jews who would join his military, yes, military, guerrilla campaign. Oh, when we go through this, you'll see how true that is. Go read Brandon's work, University of Manchester. A Lutheran minister wrote all about this in a book called Jesus and the Zealots. Modern Christians don't want to hear this. They like to poo and pot it, but it's true. And that's just the history of it. We know this from our own Jewish sources. Yeshu was a racist. And we do not share this. When I was originally doing my research for this material, you know, something, I just got distracted because somebody wrote here in the text a big long note, and I'm going to comment to him. Michael, you really think I have time to like read this when I'm teaching? Please put it in an email. I'll read it later. For those of you who wish to join me live, you're always welcome to do so. This is how we interact. But got to write in like little snippets so I can like read it as we're going along. But getting back to the issue here, Yeshu's relationship with non-Jews was not a good thing. And when I was originally studying this years ago, I called up a number of different rabbis that I know. All one more ultra-Orthodox Haredi than the other. Sephardim, Ashkenazim, Hasidim alike. And I asked, and I said, now I didn't tell them why I was asking, but I asked, if a non-Jewish individual came to you, male or female, and asked you for a blessing, what would you do? How would you respond? And absolutely every single one of them, some of whom might have been racist themselves, said, I would be honored. I would be the greatest thing. No one responded, ugh, disgusting, I would never. No one. I remember a story that happened many, many years ago, where in which a Palestinian couple, that's right, the people, you know, supposedly hate the Israelis, apparently the wife couldn't have a child, and the Palestinian husband and wife went to the great Kabbalist Rav Kadori, the one who did not believe in Yeshua in spite of all the popular stuff today. And I know that personally, because I spoke with Rav Kadori personally, and I know that topic with him. But anyway, Rav Kadori blessed the man and his wife that they should have a son. And indeed they did. And what do you think they named him? Mohammed? Ahmad? Abdullah? No. They named him Yitzchak in Hebrew, in honor of the great rabbi. That is the making of peace. We don't call people dogs. But in Yeshu's context, he considered the Gentiles unworthy. And I think that it would be most unsettling, however historically accurate, that if we could time machine Yeshu to the present, he would look at every Christian today, everyone, however good they were, as Goyim. And I say that in the derogatory way, because apparently from his own words, as we see here recorded, that's how he looked at people. I consider that shameful. And you can say, well, if you look at the Talmud, there were rabbis who didn't like Gentiles either. Like I said, Yeah, it does go both ways. I'm not going to deny it. I will not cover up racism of my own, not my personally, but of my own religion, my own companions, my own fellow rabbis. No. If I expect others to give it up, they got to fess up to it just like we do. I mean, that's just the way it has to go. But now, continuing. I actually like these words here. Ask and it shall be given. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it shall be opened to you. For everyone that asks receives, everyone that seeks finds, and to him that's knocked it shall be opened. Now, I get that. Alright? However, I think those types of words are rather misinterpreted. Right? Ask and it shall be given. Lord, I need that new Mercedes Benz. Should I pause class, go outside and see if one materialized in my parking lot? I don't think so. Alright? Knock and it shall be opened to you. All right, I want the numbers of the winning lottery. All right, for everyone who asks receives. Winning lottery numbers? It was 400 million last week. How about, you know? Nuh-uh. This is not what it's meant. And I think that people misinterpret faith to think that they can get whatever they want if they believe hard enough. I think that's very misleading. There is an entire school of theology that developed in the previous century that was based upon these types of, believe it or not, Gnostic and occultic concepts. And, you know something? I don't buy it. Moving right along. What man is there if his son asks for bread, we'll give him a stone? Okay? If he asks for a fish, he'll give him a serpent. I think that's a big difference between God providing our needs as opposed to our wants. If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more shall your Father who is in heaven give good things to them that ask him? Well, if you remember, this is why we have the Shemona Esrei, the Amidah prayer, which is a collective prayer for the community. So it's not just the dear God, gimme, 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 amen prayer, but rather provide for us. Moving right along. Here we go, the famous one. This is right out of the Talmud, a very, very famous story, which I'm going to share with you verbatim. The golden rule, the Christians call it. Therefore, all things whatsoever that ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets. The famous golden rule. Where does this come from? This is right out of the Talmud, out of Tractate Shabbat, a very famous story about Hillel. I'll read it to you. It says here, there's a story about a certain non-Jew who once came to Shammai and said to him, make me a convert. In the time that you can teach me the entire Torah while I'm balancing myself on one foot. So what does Shammai do? Apparently he won't cast his pearls before swine. It says he pushes him away with a builder's ruler that he was holding in his hand. But now this non-Jewish individual went to Hillel. And Hillel accepted that he would convert him. And this is what he taught him. He says, do not do to others what you do not want done to yourself. And here's the interesting. This is the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Hillel was of the generation before Yeshu. Yeshu is quoting Hillel. But Hillel says one other thing here, which I consider to be some of the most important words of them all. Zil Gamar, which is Aramaic for go and do it. In other words, what our sages have always taught with regards to all the 613 commandments, they're divided into two basic categories. Commandments between man and God, and commandments between man and men. And, as rabbis throughout the centuries have always echoed, the commandments between men and men, righteous, moral, decent behavior, must always take precedent. It's a sign of religious hypocrisy, where people wish to be strict, but the law is between man and God, and at the same time lenient, in other words, non-observing, of the laws between our fellow human beings. You'll find echoed in the Talmud, it's best to be strict in observing the laws of proper righteousness and behavior. And the laws between man and God, God understands. But now, continuing. Enter ye at the straight gate, for the gate is wide and broad is the path that leads to destruction. Many there will be which go in the reet. Because straight is the gate, narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few be that find it. Well, there's the wide road and the narrow road. You take the high road, I'll take the low road, right? I'll be in Scotland before you, and the rest. All right, follow the yellow brick road and all the rest of that stuff. But again, this is an interesting echo that you will find in later prophetic, messianic, and Kabbalistic teachings, that it states that even though the Torah goes forth, when the time comes in the messianic times, those who will, if you will, live to see it, it says one two of a family or one of a city, very, very few. And that's always been the case. If you look at it, the world of religion today, we are beset with hypocrisy, insanity, religious extremisms of all kinds. So much so that many people just want to throw it all away in disgust. Well, you can't do that. Like the old saying, you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater just because the bathwater is dirty. But it's so hard today to navigate through those streams. It is, can be compared to walking the razor's edge. I know so many people in urban ultra-Orthodox communities who are desperate to leave, who I begged, come out here to Tennessee, join me, start our community, work with us, and they're afraid to leave. They're afraid to be ostracized. They're afraid, actually, one or two have said, of violence. This is very bad. And that fear is very overwhelming. But yet, they cannot escape the harmful influences around them, which from the outside can act like a poison to destroy. The straight and narrow path, oh, our sages have talked about it always. But this is what it always requires of us. Again, a Jewish teaching here. And now, listen to this. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravening wolves. You shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes or thorns, of figs or thistles? So even so, every good tree bring forth good fruit, but corrupt tree bring forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not good fruit is to hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore by their fruits shall you know them. This is what we call in Hebrew a mashal. A mashal is a parable, commonly used by the rabbis. You see it all the time in the Talmud and the Zohar, everywhere. What's all this good tree, bad tree, and good fruit, bad fruit stuff? Who's he talking about? Think about it. Christians will want to say false prophets are people who are not truly preaching the gospel of Christianity. They're not in line with what Paul taught, or this one or that one taught. Oh, really? You know something? Most Christians might be shocked to know, but Yeshu actually never, ever read the Christian Bible. He never read the epistles of Paul. Never ever met Paul at all. Probably wouldn't have liked him if he did. Who are the false prophets? Number one, there are no prophets. Since the days of the last prophets of the Bible, there are no prophets. I question whether or not the actual term used in the original was what we would call in Hebrew a Navi Sheker. Now, it might be because the term today is still used, but in a more metaphorical, symbolic way. If we're to refer to somebody as a Navi Sheker, we're not saying that he is actually a prophet. Thus saith the Lord. And yet we have loonies out there all the time who say, God told me to do this. God told me to do it. Yeah, I'm speaking the words of God. We hear this all the time. This is a clear case of psychological ego aggrandizement. And it's very dangerous. If anybody's a false prophet, that's them. And you'll find this is equally guilty, or if I should say an equal psychological problem, in the Jewish community, Christian community, Islamic community, probably in others as well. People could be really nice, but they're convinced that their God's talking to them. And that's, what can I say? So, you'll know them by their fruits. In other words, their behavior. Okay, let's look at behaviors. Jews, through 2,000 years of Christian exile, what were their fruits? They built communities, they worked together, and they suffered persecution, beaten, killed. What did Christians do? Well, look at the Crusades, look before it, look after it. Look at all the attacks, the anti-Semitism, and the violence. While your average Christian reading these words today would say, oh, they're speaking about those who aren't doctrinally pure Christians. I will say to you that Yeshu, if he were alive today, would say, this is the church in its entirety, Protestant, Catholic alike, because there is still such animosity, anti-Semitism, Jew-hating. I saw even recently in one of the book reviews about this supposed book, a crazy book, that says that Rav Kadori said that the Mashiach's name was Yeshu. You all know that story is absolutely false. It never happened. It was not his handwriting. Rav Kadori could not and would not have written such a thing. I personally spoke with Rav Kadori many years ago about Yeshu, and I know his views on it. So I know all of that's a bunch of lies. And yet, one of the reviews of the book was saying, how could Rav Kadori the Jew speak about Yeshu in a positive light when he is one of those who are called the enemy of the risen Christ? An enemy? Oh, really? I don't know if that was Paul's words somewhere, but to refer to all Jews like that, that's not anti-Semitic? I'm sorry, yes it is. So, you will judge them by their fruits. That's their actions. Remember like James said, another Jewish boy, faith without works is dead. So when I look to my brother and sister Christians, my Christian neighbors, I say, I'm not interested in your doctrine or your theology. I don't care what you believe. I care what you do. And I know numerous God-fearing, Bible-believing, good Christians who believe you me. I would much rather have as my neighbors than certain of my own people who, shall I say, I'm very happy that we live at least 5 or 6 states away from. How's that? Know them by their fruits. If you got to judge somebody, take a bite of the fruit and see how sweet it is. And if it's bitter, spit it out. It's a good social message, but an important one. Moving on. Again, listen to this and decide who Yeshu, the Jew, is talking about. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but that doth the will of my Father which is in heaven. They put Lord in capital words here. Now, from what I understand from the Greek, it's a word called kurios. Now, I'm not a big Greek scholar, but they say that it's related to the Hebrew word Ado, and here they make a mistake. They think it's Adonai, meaning the name of God, but no. The same letters, Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, are not pronounced Adonai, God, but Adoni, little vowel difference, and it's Sir. To this very day, when you go into the Israeli Defense Forces, you call your officer Adoni, Sir. Yes, Sir, Ken Adoni. It's the common, proper title of respect. If Yeshua were to refer to himself as Adoni, I get that. But to think that he would call himself Adonai? A last crazy guy who wanted to say something like that? Think of like a Shabtai Tzvi in the 16th century. That's a la-la loony. That's ego aggrandizement going off the scale. Again, Christians say, he's God! Well, I know that's what you believe, my Christian friends. I'm not going to argue the point with you. If you want to believe that he's God, that's between you and God. But I will tell you, based upon a Jewish understanding, Yeshu, the Jew, would never have thought of himself as God. That's just the truth of it. So, what is this going to those who say they're going to go into the kingdom of heaven? But does the will of my Father in heaven? Did he say my Father or our Father? It's very common to this very day to say Avinu Shebeshamayim, our Father in heaven. I'm not so sure that they would actually, he would have said that Avi. So again, remember, I have a lot of critical questions with regards to the text when you look at it from a Jewish point of view. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord. Again, they're projecting him within the context like he's God and he's judge in heaven. I can't see the historical Yeshu ever talking like that because he never would have. All right? Many will say to me, we have prophesied in your name, we cast out devils, we've done many wondrous works. In other words, sound and light shows. And he says, and then I will profess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye who work iniquity. What is iniquity? Bottom line, like any Jewish rabbi would tell you, those who violate the Torah and the commandments. Yeshua himself said that. Right back at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Think not that I've come to abolish the law. This is why we observe the Torah and the mitzvot. This is God's revealed will. And I can think to this day, how many people are going to be heartbroken to think that because they hold to a theology that they're going to expect some kind of reward for it and not be held accountable for their immoral behaviors towards their fellow man. And notice I didn't say I'm talking about Christians, because I'm not. I'm talking about Jews, Christians, everybody. Somehow, somewhere, when the time comes, whether it be at the great pearly gates in the afterlife or in a time in the future in this world, one way or another, our humanity is energy. And our energy has to be properly calibrated at a specific frequency. That's called righteousness or holiness, depending on the frequency. And if we are out of sync, not calibrated properly, well, then you got to be fixed. And you're going to say, hey, wasn't I religious? Didn't I do this and that? No. Sometimes it's just not good enough. Moving right along. Therefore, whoever hear these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who builds a house upon a rock. And the rain descends and the floods came and the winds blew and beat upon that house and it fell not because it was founded upon a rock. Kind of reminds me of the three little pigs, you know, the house of brick. Okay. And everyone that hears these sayings and does not do them shall be likened to a foolish man who builds his house upon sand. Rain comes, flood came, winds blow, beat down the house, and it fell. Isn't this good Musar? Musar, again, being moralistic teachings. This is the way it's supposed to be. And that's the way we're supposed to understand something. So anyway, moving right along. That ends the Sermon on the Mount. And now you have the response here of the people. And I was very curious about this. I did a wee bit of research, and I'll share with you what I found. Let's read verse 28 and 29. And it came to pass when Yeshu had said these sayings that the people were astonished at his doctrine. Oh, really? They were astonished at his doctrine? Well, based upon everything that we have just read now in the last 3 weeks, why were they astonished? Hillel had been saying this for a while, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Yeshua ben Parachia. All of these things have been around. Remember, in those days, they didn't have printed books like we do today. People learned orally. And these teachings were floating around for at least decades until they were now put in Yeshu's mouth. And we all, you know, who knows what the actual history of the speech, if you will, the drasha, was. There was nothing astonishing in it. I don't think that the word astonished, even though it might be in the Greek, I don't think that was an accurate description. I think they were probably more perplexed, maybe even confused. Why? Because of what it says in the next verse. And I quote, "For he taught them," and this is what this version says, "as one having authority and not as the scribes." What does that mean? "Well, I say to you." Well, what do the scribes say? Somebody else says to you? First of all, you must understand that the Hebrew word for authority is moshel. Okay? However, it's the same word as mashal, which means parables. And it does make more sense to me for saying that they would have been perplexed by his doctrine, for he taught them as parables and not as the scribes, who were known to be meticulously, as we'd say in Hebrew, very pshat, very straightforward. Granted, from time to time the rabbis spoke in parables, but for the most part they were straightforward shooters, if you will, because they were trying to get people to understand. I believe from other places that one of the great complaints against Yeshu was that he always spoke in parables and they didn't understand. And if we understand these two verses in that light, then it makes sense. But to say that he spoke with authority, astonished with his doctrine, the scribes had authority. The Pharisees had authority. The Essenes had an authority. So I don't see that authority here that the Christian is, if you will, predisposed to see. I mean, they're going to see it because they want to see it. I'm sorry. Not only do I not see it, I don't see what the historical people, all traditional Jews. Now, let's project who the audience of Yeshu was. You got a Rebbe who's sitting up on a hill somewhere talking to the people. Okay. Who is going out to listen to him? The people who don't care about religion? Well, why would they be listening to a Rebbe? The people who are anything other than religious. In other words, the people who are going to go and listen to a Rebbe are people who are interested. And most likely, Yeshu was not the first Rebbe they listened to. So they would have been exposed to and have heard many of these teachings. Once he starts giving the golden rule, they wouldn't say, "Wow, what an astonishing teaching." Half the people in the crowd would have nodded their heads and said, "Yeah, that's what Hillel said." When he says, "Judge not, they be not judged," and they go, "Yeah, we read it. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Tarfon, yeah, we heard these things." Their response would not have been, "Wow, what a profound revelation we've never heard before." It's just not the history. I have a question here in text. Do I think Yeshu was considered a rabbi of his times? And the answer, of course, is yes. Indeed, I remember many, many years ago when I was actually studying in Yerushalayim, I heard it once suggested that, well, the actual history of Yeshu's father, the rabbis, is described differently in Judaism, certainly as it is in Christianity. But the Jewish sources stated that if that fallout did not occur, it would be very possible that Yeshu would have been in the, if you will, group of the rabbis, and his name might have been found in Baraitot and Mishnayot. We might have found him as a contemporary with all the other great rabbis of his day. You might have read about him in Pirkei Avot or in a Gemara somewhere, if. So yeah, I do think he was a rabbi of his day, but I think he was much more than that. I think he was, again, the political extremist. But now, in the few moments we have left, we're going to jump into chapter 8 and introduce the concept of Yeshu's healing the people. Now, go into Josephus. The Josephus says that one of the things that the Essenes were very well known for were being natural healers. Ancient Judaism had a very profound and deep understanding of what we'll call natural medicine, herbology, and the others. Very, very involved stuff. I even heard somewhere, but I've never found it validated, that somewhere at Qumran, they found needles, which a friend of mine who was a TCM, a traditional Chinese medical doctor, said was the same size and weight, if you will, that are used in acupuncture. And he asked me, is there any known tradition of acupuncture and amongst the Essenes, to which I certainly have no idea. But it is known that the Essenes were very much involved in old healing practices, as rabbis and Kabbalists have always been throughout the centuries. Needless to mention famous Maimonides, the doctor. Now, even into recent times, the famous Baal Shem Tov, again the founder of the Hasidic movement, he was known as a healer. Now, these healers didn't heal with magic and hocus pocus. They didn't heal with invoking the names of angels. They were herbalists. They knew energy work. Energy work. Is there anything religious about that? Anybody knows anything about energy? If you know what's called in Chinese, Qigong or Tai Chi, there's nothing spiritual about that. And anybody who thinks that it is clearly mistaken. These are things that deal with the natural, normal electromagnetic energies of the body. Someone here in Texas is mentioning Reiki. No, Reiki uses symbols for visualization techniques, which they ascribe to be divine. That's the ray of the ki, chi. So no, using those symbols would be prohibited according to Jewish law, but whatever they channel, whatever. Not here to talk about that. It is said that one of the polemics stated that Yeshua was able to do miracles because he had a certain holy name of God sewn in his garment. Now, I'm not one for believing polemical writings. I think that's all a bunch of, you know, whatever. But I remember reading many years ago one of the books of Kabbalistic magic that there was supposedly a series of holy names that a person could sew into his garment and thereby perform miracles. And I said, really? Now at least I know where the concept comes from. It's an ancient concept. Did Yeshua have things sewn into his garments? I couldn't say. But I will tell you this. There is evidence to suggest in the Talmud and older sources that in those times, people would tattoo holy names on the different parts of their bodies, and it was said to give them whatever it gave them. So, did Yeshua perform miracles of healing? He very well might have, because rabbis after him always had. I know for a fact that Rabbi Mordechai Sharabi, a blessed memory of Yerushalayim, did profound things with energy. Rav Kadori did. Baba Sali, the famous Rabbi Abu Chatzir of Netivot, certainly did. And we could go back through history and every generation of rabbis doing these great profound things. To think that Yeshua could have done it, it doesn't stun me or surprise me if he did. For a Christian not knowing any different, that would be a sign of God on earth. Well, then God must have come down a lot of times, sometimes in the same generation. Right? Is Rav Kadori God? Is Rav Abu Chatzira God? Is Rav Sharabi God? Is the Baal Shem Tov God? No. You see, this is the problem that a lack of education causes. Moving right along. A few minutes we have left. It says, behold, there was a leper. And it says in the King James, and worshipped him. No. No Jew would ever worship another. Would he bow down and maybe show respect? By all means. Would he kiss his hand? By all means. to this very day, even I myself, if I go and see my Rav, I will always bow before him and kiss his hand. I'm not worshiping him, though. That's expected and appropriate behavior, especially in our Sephardic circles, to bow and kiss your rabbi's hand. That's the way we do things. I don't care if you like it or not. But worship? No. I cannot believe that Matthew would have put that word in there in the original Aramaic. I certainly don't believe that that's actually what happened. Maybe show respect, homage, maybe. Worship, definitely not. And saying, Lord, again, here we go with that word, Lord. Capital L here to think that that's somehow God. No, it's not Adonai, it's Adoni. Sir, if you will, can you make me clean? Now, that's interesting. Can you heal my leprosy? It says he put forth his hand and touched him, and he says, be clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. Is there anything else that might have happened? I remember in a future story it said that he put some mud in somebody's eyes. Why the mud? Why don't he just go hocus pocus? Well, there is a kind of, if you will, psychosomatic issue to faith. Let me give you an example. As you know, I do pastoral counseling. Now, as a pastoral counselor, and I emphasize, I am not a psychologist. I am certainly not a psychiatrist. I have no secular credentials in any of those fields. But being around doing this stuff for 30 years, I kind of, you know my way around. And I will tell you this. I've clearly seen a psychosomatic side to people who believe that dealing with the rabbi will help them more than dealing with the psychologist. I have had even psychiatrists approach me and ask for my involvement in dealing with a patient a number of times, to which I was so surprised. Why? Why would you ask me? And I was told, because they believe you'll help. And I said, well, they believe? Then I will. It's all a matter of belief. So, this is a whole concept of faith. If there is a psychosomatic element, then indeed, belief and faith can transform things. So much so that I've read in modern literature, certain types of cancer can be helped put in remission by a change of attitude, stress reduction, and meditation. So I've seen. So, I'm not surprised that this might have been some kind of a psychosomatic response. But again, listen to what Yeshu says. So he says to him, all right, see thou, tell no man. Don't tell anybody I did this. Why not? I'm the miracle worker. Wouldn't you want to advertise that? It's good for business. No. This is what makes me suspicious that I think that this might have been something psychosomatic, or maybe it wasn't real, or whatever. And Yeshu was keeping a low profile of it. But yet, listen to what he says next. Go show yourself to a Kohen at the Beit HaMikdash. Offer the gift, which is the sacrifice that Moshe commanded, for a testimony. In other words, he's telling the guy, you are obligated by halacha to go in front of the Kohen, to have yourself ritually purified, as is the law, and to offer a korban, a sacrifice in the temple, as is halacha. So, that's a pretty good thing. Yeshu here is clearly telling the guy, observe the Torah, because it's the right thing to do. I get that. Okay, we have a couple minutes. This is a big long thing here, but let's start. Now it says Yeshu entered into Capernaum. They came to him, a Roman centurion. And he says, Lord, again, the Lord, my servant lies at home sick of palsy, grievously tormented. So it says here that Yeshu's going to come and heal him. Oh, really? Yeshu's going to go to the house of a non-Jew? Again, I question. But the centurion says, no, I'm not worried that you should come under my roof. Speak the word, my servant will be healed. I'm a man under authority, commanding soldiers. And I say, this one go, and he goes. Come, and this one comes, etc. So when he says, when Yeshu heard it, he marveled. Why? And he says, you see, I have not found so great a faith, not in Israel, indicating that this guy was a non-Jew. That's rather contradictory. Prior and after, he refers to the Gentiles as dogs. Apparently, this dog he likes. So, he says that many shall come from the east and the west and shall sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the children of the kingdom shall be cast into the outer darkness, there to be weeping and gnashing their teeth. Wait a second. Who are all of these children from the east and the west? Ah, not Christians. They're what we today call Noahites, the Bnei Noach. You see, notice that said they sit at the table. This is actually a concept that's explained by Paul in his book of Romans about those grafting into the tree. These are the Noahites. Noahites, or their proper Hebrew term would be Gerei Toshav, are the righteous Gentiles who acknowledge God and walk that path in righteousness. They don't have Jewish rituals to observe, nor should they. But they live righteous and decent lives. They are our brothers and sisters and part of our extended family. They're sitting at our table. And what about the children of the kingdom? Some of our fellow Jews who, like I said, some of them I'm glad that I live five states away from. But okay, on that note, we've pretty much concluded for this class, and God be willing, we'll pick up where we left off with more of the stories and our critical and hopefully Torah-based insights into that. Thank you again all for joining me. I'm your host, Ariel Bartzadok. Come see me online at koshertorah.com. Thanks again. God bless. Good night. Shalom.